This week on the Boag World Show, we're joined by Rachel Gertz to discuss workflows, automation and kickstarting digital transformation. This week's show is sponsored by Shopify and Envision. Hello and welcome to the Boag World Show, the podcast about user experience, digital strategy and digital management. My name is Paul Boag. Joining me as always is Marcus. Hello, Marcus.
Hi, Paul. How are you doing today?
We don't even get into that. I'll get into that in just a minute. First of all, I want to welcome Rachel Gertz. How are you? Good to have you on the show, Rachel.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. I'm doing great.
Well, at least you're doing great, because I'm dying of man flu.
Oh, that's awful.
It is very, very serious.
It's not serious at all, is it? Come on.
Well, I can't work out whether it's man flu or hay fever or just motorhome misery, because I'm in the motorhome today.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
What is man flu?
Have you not heard of man flu?
No, never. Is this like a British thing?
Maybe it is. I don't know. So man flu is essentially, it's a slight sniffle and a cold. But because a man has it, it's much, much more serious.
Oh,
because we're very melodramatic about things, right? So a woman would just suck it up and get on with life as normal. But because it's a man, it's, it's life-threatening.
Oh, my goodness. What are we going to do with you?
I know.
Ignore him.
Okay. Anyway, Marcus.
Hi. I'm feeling fine. I was moaning only 2 or 3 weeks ago with the same condition, I believe.
Oh, you've affected me over the radio waves. Yeah. Is that a thing?
Well, listen, I gotta go. I
think you're all right. Thousands and thousands of miles away.
So yeah, I'm going to basically expect you two to do all the heavy lifting in this show. I'm going to just sit here slowly dripping. Ooh, from my nose.
There's no need for that kind of detail.
I know you want it.
A slow drip is better than a fast drip, in my opinion.
That's very true. It's a wise words. I think already our listeners can take away something valuable from this show, which is good. So, Rachel, tell us a bit about yourself, what you're up to these days, and because it's been a little while since we've met, isn't it?
Yeah, we actually met, I think, at a speaker's dinner last year. And I think at that dinner, we were all pouring our hearts out about the most vulnerable things. And I don't think you had man flu that day. So you have no excuses.
Well, there you go.
I'm the co-founder and partner at Louder Than 10, which is a small company in Vancouver, Canada. We don't have walls around our country, and we're not kicking anybody out. So it's a really good place for people to come and stay, and we welcome everybody. As an aside, so our company works with small to medium-sized companies, and we really focus on tightening up PM processes and doing training and workshops so that these companies can stay small and not get vacuumed up by all the big Facebooks of the world. Not that there's anything wrong with Facebook.
Wow. So you are essentially, you're not a digital PM at an agency, you know, a traditional web design agency. You actually focus just on training and management and those kinds of areas then.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I still keep my hand in a little bit of digital project management, mostly internally, but it's just something that it's just grown and the need, I think, for other teams. I mean, you guys must have noticed too, right? Digital teams really need the support and the help in terms of buckling up all their processes, because I think we're still fighting a battle here with understanding the role of PM and how it can actually really make a country, oh my goodness, mm-hmm. a company more valuable and sustainable.
So how did that come about happening? When did you set it up? What triggered it?
So it's been in this current form over 2 years now. Before that, we did run a pretty standard digital studio, and we had done some traveling, and we had spoken with a few folks and worked freelance and remote and that kind of thing. And really what it was is that, you know, with the teaching background that I have, and then my husband's and partner's, Travis, his background in sort of like making, he basically likes to hack anything that he can hack and turn it into a smarter system. So together we were really looking at like what, really, where should we spend our time? There are lots of different agencies out there and we want to be able to support those. And so, yeah, it basically kind of evolved naturally. I have to say a lot of credit goes to, Brett Harned and Carl Smith because we were, you know, we were friends and partners and colleagues back in the day and they sort of planted some seeds. I think Carl was the first guy who got me to speak. And I was terrified at the Digital PM Summit. So thanks, Carl.
So is it just the two of you or is there more of you now?
Yeah, so there's a few of us. We all work remote. We also have a strategist who helps us as well. And we have a PM consultant named Bill who's actually working with us on workshops and training. We're just getting him introduced more and more. So we're growing a little bit. We have an editor for Cokes magazine. So I think we're up to five now, but various sizes all over Canada and hopefully the US soon. So yeah.
So what was the magazine you mentioned? You said something about a magazine there.
Yeah, so we run a digital magazine and it's called Cokes or Coax if you are playing with the Louder Than 10 Spinal Tap reference. Yes. And basically it's a magazine that we started again to talk about, I mean, everything's a project, right? So we wanted people just to talk about their experiences and share sort of the things that maybe shaped who they were as people, because I find that we're all drawn to these areas in project management almost unconsciously. Like, I think you guys are probably project managers without even realizing it, right?
That's a terrifying thought, but I think it may well be true.
It is.
So how did, with the agency that you're running, are you just working on digital processes and projects or, are you looking broader? Are the principles that you teach applicable in any situation?
I mean, we definitely specialize in the digital area. What we find is like when you know the term like creative now, you can kind of expand that to any sort of thing where you're making things online and supporting other people. I mean, we kind of have expanded into that realm, but we really want to keep the focus on digital because I think if you're looking at, you know, where we're headed, technology is moving so fast. I mean, you guys know, right? Your specialty too is like integrating technology into these larger companies and really supporting those initiatives. And for us, we're sort of focusing on the little guys and the medium-sized guys and just trying to make sure that everyone's got what they need to feel, you know, confident. It's scary. It's scary to not know how to use technology, not only as a business tool, but to integrate it almost like you are a bit of a cyborg or something like that, right? Yeah.
So what kind of people are you working with then? Is it... you know, agencies or other agencies, or is it with who?
Yeah. So we're working with a number of agencies and, you know, digital marketing companies in Canada and the US, but we're also talking and working with a few product companies or those kind of folks who are in the middle where they're like, they are service companies, but they're helping product companies pass, you know, the after round one funding, and they're just trying to help them with like UI development or whatever that basic identity and brand is, and just really supporting those initiatives. Because again, in that product sphere, like they've, in a lot of cases, they've kind of done away, or maybe they just haven't included the project management role. But what we're finding is that those folks are still not able to have the tough conversations. They're still not kind of tethering anything to business goals. Forget about project goals. We know those change, but the business goals, where are those taking people? So it's that sort of mid zone, I think, that we'd like to continue to focus on and really support people who are, again, just trying to become technology companies, but stay reasonably small.
I got to say, that sounds brilliant. And it makes me all the more want to move to Canada. We were talking about this last week with Carlson Pierce.
Well, you announced earlier on that you've given up being British, I believe.
I have. I've announced it on Twitter now. It's now official. Well, it's not that I've got anything wrong with Britain. I announced that I've given up being British because I've just decided that the whole idea of nationhood is a bit screwy and rubbish,
yeah,
really.
It is.
You know, it's like we're in the world that we work in, you know, where borders are nothing but an inconvenience, really. You know, the fact that I have to charge different currencies and worry about different taxation and all of this kind of stuff. So it would be very convenient if we could just get rid of all nations and people could just go where they wanted. That would be, I don't know, something like a big single common market where people can move from country to country and there's a freedom of movement.
Sounds familiar, that.
It does sound familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'm in, you guys. Do you want to do this? Let's make it happen.
Well, do you know what I think we ought to do? I think we ought to resurrect the British Empire. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that Britain should rule it anymore.
Okay.
I'm just saying, if you look at all of the countries that were in the British Empire at the height of the British Empire, right, and said that they were a single common market where you could travel through any of those countries and work where you want, that would be a bloody cool set of countries.
It would, actually. I mean, I would sign up. I would be okay with that.
Yeah, because, I mean, you could come work in the UK or the States or Canada. You could work in South Africa, India. You know, most of the world would be your oyster.
I mean, basically, yeah, because you guys took over almost the whole world at one point, didn't you?
we just walk into countries, we put a flag in it and call it ours.
Well, the Americans celebrated getting rid of us on Monday, didn't they?
Yeah, that's, you know.
Oh, I guess, yeah, I didn't even look at it that way.
Well, so did Canada not long ago.
True.
You had a Canada Day not long back.
July 1st, yeah, that was.
Yeah.
And so, ours is 149 years.
That's not long, is it, if you think of it like that?
Baby country, just a baby.
Well, you're doing pretty good for a baby country. Seems like everyone wants to move to you. Have you seen the thing in the news about the amount of people that are now searching how to emigrate to Canada?
No, I didn't see that.
It's skyrocketed. Mm. I tell you, you're going to, with the combination of Brexit and also Trump,
oh my God.
I think you're going to have this massive influx of really annoying British and American people.
I want the smart British people.
Yeah. You just want the smart people, yeah.
I thought it would be smart. Like, the people who want to leave are the ones who are like, well, you know, I weighed my options, and I'm just feeling like Canada's got some good offerings right now.
Yeah, absolutely. But as we said last week, it is too cold.
Wait. Where are you talking about moving? That's the key, you guys.
Well, where are you based?
I'm on Vancouver. I'm on Vancouver's west coast here. So the coldest it gets is maybe 2 degrees. No snow.
Oh, okay.
Very mild. Warmest is 27 in the summer.
See, now that sounds good.
Is that 2 degrees Celsius?
Yeah, no, we don't do that weird Fahrenheit stuff. That's bizarre.
Okay. We do Fahrenheit when it's hot, but we do centigrade.
Do you?
No, we don't. Only old people like you do that, Marcus.
People still say it's 90 and 85.
No, they don't. Only your geriatric friends.
Nobody says it's 32 when it's freezing. That's completely gone.
Yes, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah, definitely.
I didn't even realize this, but, you know, so when the metric system replaced the imperial system in Canada, it was, I think, during the late 70s. I just researched this. I'm such a horrible nerd with these things, but I found out that there was this entire political motivation behind who wanted to have which system in power, and it actually became a big deal, and a lot of people in the Canadian political scene were like treated very poorly and I think maybe even ousted as a result of where things went, because we ended up adopting metric, and it affects obviously construction and I mean every kind of position you can imagine, right? So that's why our parents' generation, there's like, when you try to get them to think in metric, it's an interesting pushback that you get. And I think our generation still is on the fence. We know both systems. For metric, like for measuring with tapes or, you know, cups versus tablespoons, all of those things, we think in imperial. And then everything else is metric. It's so bizarre, you guys. And my weight, I've never calculated my weight in kilograms.
No, me neither.
No, neither have I.
No.
Yeah.
We drive in miles.
Do you?
Yeah. What do you? You,
well, see,
you do kilometres.
Distance is kilometres.
Oh, wow. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, distance is in miles, but...
Huh.
And this is what really screws with your head. When you're in a car and you're driving, it's kind of miles and yards. But if you were if I was measuring, I don't know, a cabinet, it would be in meters and centimeters.
What? That's opposite us. How does this happen?
I know, it's weird, isn't it?
We should.
And also, measure my weight in stone and pounds.
Mm. What's a stone again?
14 pounds.
That's so arbitrary. What does that mean? 14.
That's imperial measurements, aren't they? They're all so arbitrary.
If I weigh 180 pounds, that's about 13 stone, something like that.
And do you do leagues as well? Is that?
No.
Oh, that's on that. Ooh, is that a seafaring?
Yeah.
Maybe. But
we don't. I don't go anywhere near the sea.
Race courses are measured in furlongs, which is an ancient measurement. So yeah, we serious stuff. You know, if you're going to build a house, for example, that's always millimeters, meters, anything like that. Or if you're going to build a space station, that would not be an imperial. But
so if
sorry.
Oh, sorry, Marcus. Yeah. I was going to say if we made our own. I don't want to say it's going to be the British Isles or anything, because that seems like you guys already have an idea around what could happen there. But if we made our own version of like no boundaries in the entire world, what system are we going to, we have to pick a system.
Oh, well, we'd definitely go metric.
Metric's much more sensible. Have you seen the triangle, the diagram of US versus the rest of the world? And it's kind of like, I'll see if I can find it for you. Carry on talking.
And it is a ridiculous thing. It's, you know, but then things like that you've got to work out as well. Like, you know, what currency we would use.
Oh, what currency would we use?
I know, we'd have to make up a new one. But this is, of course, this is the situation we're now in Britain, that we're trying to undo all of those things we've made up.
I kind of noticed that.
It's very complicated. And going back to what you were saying about the introduction of imperial and metric and how it became politicized, mm-hmm. that's exactly what's happened with the EU thing. It's had nothing really to do with, you know, what's right or wrong or best for the country. A lot of it was just politicians maneuvering and arguing with one another and wanting to get into power. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's sad but true, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be interesting to keep an eye on what happens, because I'm sure that nobody expected it in the way that it rolled out, right? So, I mean, I'm curious if you guys, what do you think could happen in the US? Do you think that?
I think he could get in.
Yeah.
From what I've read, the feeling is that he won't, because the kind of more moderate vote, more women, just a generally more kind of left wing way of thinking has come much more to the fore in the past 8 years in America than was there before. This is the argument. So in theory, no far right wing candidate could get in, but it remains to be seen, I think.
Yeah, it does. I think I'm just going to sit with my popcorn and watch the whole thing unfold. So.
The trouble is that, you know, you can get what you got here in the UK, which is a protest vote.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, where people aren't actually saying, I want Trump, they're saying, I want things to change.
Yeah.
You know, and Hillary is not exactly, you know, a figure that people go, oh, yeah, if we've got Hillary, everything's going to change. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very much
exactly
a vote
love.
For the status quo.
Yeah. We want the same or we want worse. I think those are the choices.
Yes. What's that? What's that you've just pinged us then,
it's
file?
Comparison from United States to the rest of the world. The United States is described as an arbitrary retarded roller coaster. 12 inches to a foot, three feet to a yard, 1,760 yards to a mile, 16 ounces to a pound. And then comparison with logical smooth sailing to the rest of the world with 1,000 millimeters to a meter, 1,000 meters to a kilometer, 1,000 grams to a kilogram, 1,000 kilograms to a ton.
Wow.
Just which you've got to say is much more sensible, isn't it, really? But there you go.
I agree.
From a usability perspective.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Although that's where it kind of maybe falls down a bit, and that's why we still use some imperial things like feet and inches and pounds, because they are actually more, you know, a pound of weight is more, it's an easier weight to deal with as a human than a big kilogram is.
That's true.
It's more kind of like, you know, it's too big kilogram, you know, thinking in kilograms, whereas pounds are much nicer.
Yeah, didn't we form all of that based on amounts we could hold and sizes of our feet and lengths of rope and all these weird sort of human-based measurements? Mm-hmm. We just we just determined the entire world around our own needs, and then it suited everybody really, really well for a number of years and then stopped.
But then you could say the same as what about, you know, our basic system of maths that we use 10, mm-hmm. you know, multiples of 10, because we happen to have 10 fingers.
Oh, that's so true.
Mm. Well, so tens are really easy to deal with mathematically as well. That's why metric works so well mathematically, yeah. But maybe not in a kind of touchy-feely way.
Yeah, no, that's a very quite profound, Marcus.
We're getting deep anyway, here. I like
it. Can I go back to sleep now?
Yeah.
I've got my gist for today.
All right, I'll talk about a sponsor for a bit.
Cool.
That'll avoid you having to say anything. I want to talk about Envision just very briefly. Envision, I have a suite of prototyping and design tools that we've talked about on this show over the last few weeks. We've talked in particular about their amazing prototyping tools. But one element of that we haven't talked about is the great animations they provide. So you can take a static design comp and you can upload it. And you can create insanely high definition, high fidelity animations, transitions and effects without having to write a single line of code. Because the truth is that most of the applications and websites that we build these days, you know, animation is a key factor in making it successful. So being able to demonstrate that at the prototype stage is really, really important. And that's what Envision allows you to do. It even allows you to add touch gestures if you're prototyping a mobile app or something like that. You can add animations or transitions from a library of pre-made effects that they've got. And then you can go in and customize those animations to be exactly as you want. But they've also got this thing called motion, and motion makes it very easy to adjust the timing, duration and easing of any animation you can create. And if you want to get really technical, you can also dive into motion's code editor and take even more control over that, how the animation presents itself and how it works. So if you fancy having to fiddle around with all the great animation features in Envision, or just giving the whole thing a go, then you can get a free 3-month trial with unlimited prototypes, mobile use of testing and boards and all the other things that we've talked about over the last few weeks. All you need to do is you go to boag.world/envision and you enter the code INV-BOAG. I really encourage you to check out Envision. They are a really great sponsor and a really good product that a huge number of people use. So please take a moment to check them out. Okay, so we come to the questions that have been submitted. And I've got to say, it's a really great set of questions that we've got, which I think will be very suited to you, Rachel, as the back, you know, as I've heard a bit more about your background and what it is that you do. So I'm hoping that you're going to have some bits and bobs to share. And I'm sure, Marcus, you will do too.
One or two, maybe.
Yeah. So the first one is from Prescott. We've had some questions already from Prescott, but he's submitted some good ones. So let's do another, which is, how can small teams build cohesion around a workflow and not just a software title? So a lot of small teams, I don't know, they get Basecamp or whatever else. But just because you've got a good software title doesn't necessarily mean you've got a good workflow that goes with it. And it strikes me, Rachel, this is very much your bread and butter, is it not?
Definitely. It fits right in line with that focal point.
And I didn't know that when I selected the question. Oh. So that worked out very well. It's, you know, because I could have pretended that I planned this in some way, but obviously,
I would have given you full credit for that, by the way, just so you know.
Yeah, I've ruined it. So what's your what kind of things do you tell small teams around workflow?
Right. So, I mean, workflow isn't just the tool you use or the way that you work. Workflow is almost the mental placement of where your team is at and how you interact with each other. So I think one of the biggest things that we come back to is when people start saying, not my job, it's that terrible point of view, right? Based on like, I have to protect my role, what I do in this company, and that is not part of that. That is not out, that is outside of what my specialty is. So I'm not going to ask questions. I'm not going to interact with you on those things. And I'm not going to try to steer the project in the direction that it should go. So interestingly enough, we already talked about sort of the other, you know, intensity that that can lead to in terms of not in my backyard or not in my country, right? So that attitude is not an attitude that leads to healthy, productive teams. So when we talk about making sure that workflow feels good, I always, you know, we really reinforce, make sure it's focused on goals and make sure that the roles of the teammates that you have are kind of focusing on meeting at critical intersection points. So like, here's an example. Like, when do you guys figure most miscommunications happen on a team when you're dealing with digital processes?
Oh, when do the most probably near the beginning, I would have thought, where things are pretty woolly. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is there like a specific example you guys can think of where, you know, typically the breakdown will happen?
Oh, well, you often get breakdowns, in my experience, where a designer and a developer are working together, and the designer has produced some, you know, beautiful graphic or, you know, some kind of functionality, and the developer has misunderstood what that, you know, how that will work or how that will operate. And you get the similar thing with the client as well, that they look at, say, a static comp. And they're under the impression that, you know, it will work in a certain way or will look the same on all browsers or whatever else. And because you're not seeing the full picture.
Exactly.
Yeah. What we've found is a kind of extension of that is if you're, because a design process or the build process of a website, design is happening all the time. So it's, even though you might get an early sign off of a comp, you're still designing new bits and bobs all the time. And what we've tended to find is that you'll get maybe not miscommunication, but you'll get hurdles when the designer designs a new piece, a new part of the design further into the project that doesn't really fit with the kind of, you know, the structures that the front end designer has put together. So that's a pretty good example of where we get a lot of hiccups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when that front end structure doesn't meet the back end, and there's basically a pain point that happens, right? And that fundamental breakdown is what usually lends itself to scope increases and schedule changes and all these other things. So, you know, when we're focusing on workflow, we're not just looking at what's the tool set. It's like, let's build a checklist for where those things tend to happen so that we can reinforce and strengthen those project goals, right? Make sure that we know, are we doing well? How do we know we're doing well? Are we doing terribly? How do we know that? And just making sure that we're not sort of assuming that we understand where our teammates are at with their understanding between those points. So really like re-asking the same questions can be, you know, really helpful. And we use things like root cause analysis or the five whys, you know, that Toyota model where basically you don't just stop at the first why something's happening, but you go back five layers of why to determine the true source of the problem.
That's really interesting. I never knew that was an established methodology because I've instinctively not gone that five levels, but you know, I always talk about how powerful asking the question why is.
Yeah.
But you can't just ask it once. You have to keep digging, don't you?
Exactly. It's like that curiosity that you had when you were a child where your parents would keep telling you to be quiet. And it was like, no, I need to know why. And that is the key to really, I think, getting all of these questions answered. And we could probably fix politics and economics if we kept asking why.
But I mean, going back to what you were saying about the intersection between two different people's roles, because that's inevitably where workflow falls down. How do you define areas of responsibility in such a way that those edges are fluid enough to have conversations? So, for example, you know, you were saying that some people go, well, that's not my job, so I'm not going to do anything about it. And they just shrug their shoulders and walk away. But on the other hand, somebody who comes along and interferes in someone else's job can be bloody annoying at times, can't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a balance to be struck there, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. You're right. Because you can't have everyone doing the same things. Because,
yeah.
I mean, imagine, like, there would be so many problems from the outset. But I think, yeah, it's having a lot of conversations and having clarity from the beginning about, okay, this is the stuff that I do really well at. I know how to ask the right questions. I know where to go to get help. This is the stuff that you're really good at. You also know how to ask the right questions and who to go to. Where are the areas that are gray? And I think if you can define those gray areas together, you can make sure that, you know, there shouldn't be technically handoffs. It's like just this collaborative, you know, movement of the project where there are no breakdowns that happen. And when anyone is, you know, confused about where things are at, it's like, again, coming back to what are we trying to accomplish? How does this support the goals of maybe the project, but also the business of or the company that we're working with? So I think it has to be around asking the right questions. I don't know. What do you guys find works for you?
I think, you know, in Headscape, we're in quite a good position in the sense that people have worked together for so long that they've kind of worked that out themselves. Mm-hmm. Is that fair enough to say, Marcus?
Yeah. I mean, my take on this question is a little bit of a tangent from it, because when Emma joined 18 months ago, our project manager, she sort of took it on herself to try and find the right software title for us, taking that from the question. And we've just struggled to find something that supports the way we work completely, you know, kind of end to end. And it doesn't exist, mm-hmm. as we found out. So I think my take from that question is, don't try and rely on a software title at all. Use them where they're appropriate as part of your process. But if you just think that this thing, this package is going to build cohesion for you, it isn't, because we found that out ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's a continual problem, isn't it? Where people think some piece of technology is going to be the magic bullet that solves their problems. And it, you know, it's not really, you know, your workflow needs to be built around the people and the characters that, you know, that you're working with more than anything else, because different people like to work in different ways, you know. So some people want to be able to shut themselves off and focus for other times. Others are going to want to be working side by side. So in a sense, I'm going to say the word that you're not meant to say on this show, which is it depends, you know, because every team is different and every group of people is different.
I think that teams need to constantly review how they work and be upfront with each other about the things that aren't working and try to fix those things on an ongoing basis. Mm-hmm. That's how we work. You know, because we're doing ongoing projects all the time. So mm-hmm. issues will crop up and people might get a bit upset about this, that, or the other. And we'll then take that on board and say, right, okay, how can we fix that? And then, you know, maybe 6 months later, another issue will appear, and we'll adjust our workflow accordingly around that. So it's just, you know, constantly talking to each other, basically.
Yeah, you're right.
It's I guess the danger of that is you can spend a lot of time in meetings. You know, there can be a lot of time of navel gazing rather than actually getting on with the work. To play devil's advocate,
We used to do daily stand-ups as a team, and we realized that they were meant to be 5-10 minute things, and they ended up being half an hour to an hour. So that was certainly the case if we were doing more meetings than working. But then it got completely dumped because we were so busy, and we basically stopped kind of having, you know, set times where we're going to sit down and talk to each other about what we're working on, what's working, what isn't. So we've brought that back into a kind of weekly lunch meeting now, because you've got to find it's another balance thing. You do need to talk to each other about these things, but yeah, don't overdo it, otherwise you'll end up just talking about things and not doing things. So, but yeah, we've gone back to kind of a weekly thing, which seems to be working at the moment.
That's good. You know, I was reading this article and it was actually talking about like how do you have or maintain like a really good marriage or a relationship? And it says like, despite what you think is the cause of a breakdown, which usually bends on money, jobs or tasks and sex, instead of that, it's actually around failure to meet expectations. And so, of course, my PM brain goes back to, oh, well, how does that work in our roles? Like, when do we fail to meet our team's expectations and how does that impact the level of communication? Because like, if you thought about it as a marriage, it would be like, well, if you're going to over communicate, is that going to prevent you from doing marriage or from, you know, actually partaking in the process of marriage? And it's like, you're just basically rolling out these regular conversations that they just become part of checking in, you know, and you're not like that hovering nervous person that everyone hates as a partner, but just the relaxed, like, How are people feeling about things? You know, is this working? What can we change instead of waiting till the end of a project to have that retrospective? Just do it throughout, right?
Mm. It's the little and often approach, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's always better to talk, you know, on a regular basis rather than, you know, wasting, you know, hours every once in a while. It's just like usability testing, as we always say, we usability testing. And I think it's true as well with any form of communication, you know, little and often. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's look at our second question. Right, this one is from Charles. How do you get people from across your organization interested or even, I like that, mm-hmm. he's really pushing the bow out here, or even enthused about participating in digital transformation work? So this is about engagement, isn't it? I mean, Rachel, do you do a lot in regards to digital transformation? It sounds like a lot of your clients are fairly savvy already.
So far, a lot of the clients we've worked with, they're familiar with digital processes. It's just not knowing how to sort of automate or make them really, really simple. So, but I think you guys, like that, you definitely have a specialty in that area for sure, right?
Yeah, this is more my kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I was just interested because I don't think in some regards, whether you're talking about getting people in an organization interested or enthused about anything is pretty much the same. You know, you could take digital transformation out of that sentence and say user experience, or you could say, you know, processes and workflows, or you could say anything you want. The thing that I think has really struck me over this, Charles, is as I'm sitting writing this book at the moment about building user experience culture in an organization, that it's not all about management dictating these things from the top. I've worked with a number of organizations where someone within the senior management team has said, we need to digitally transform. Right, or you know, we need to become more user centric or whatever it is. And there's this feeling that, you know, if senior management say we need to do this, then everything's going to be lovely and special. But it doesn't work out like that. In actual fact, it's got to be very much, you need management support, don't get me wrong, but I think it very much has to be a grassroots campaign. And I think for me, it begins by establishing a small group of people that already get it, whether it be whatever it is you're trying to convince them of. So bring together a small group of people that already understand the value of what you're doing and get that, turn that group into a bit of a community. Because then what you're doing is you're creating a bridgehead within the organization, a little unified core of people that can make a difference. And I often think you need to unify people around something, a set of values. So, you know, if you say about we want people to get involved in digital transformation, well, what does that actually mean? You know, we want people to do to this organization to be more committed to user experience design. Well, what does that actually mean? Mm-hmm. So the kind of manifestos and principles, design principles you see around a lot these days, like the UK government digital service, like the US playbook, Google's got one. These kinds of documents are a very, very simple set of values that kind of unite people. And then from there, it's really about starting and undertaking an internal comms campaign and systematically reaching out to people, whether it be through internal newsletters, internal blogs, running internal conferences, I always find is really good, getting outside speakers in. It's a huge subject that Charles is asking about, but it is, you know, it needs to begin by getting that unified group of people together.
Hmm. I remember Jared, when we spoke to Jared Spall about this, and this was more kind of how do you get senior management buy-in, but I think that applies across the board actually. And just to kind of summarize what he was saying is speak to them in their terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Use terminology that they understand, that they can, you can, if you're describing something to them in their terms, then they can see the benefit of it, basically. And I think that applies across an organization. Not everybody does what we do. So you need to kind of, explain the benefits of whatever it is, digital transformation, user centric stuff, whatever, in terms that people will understand.
Mm-hmm. And I think the key thing you said there, Marcus, is so that they can see the benefits to them as well. That, you know, I think inherently most of us are pretty selfish. And that's not necessarily, you know, I don't mean that to sound as bad as it came across, maybe, but, you know, we're worried about our own little bubble, our own little world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're talking to somebody from procurement, you need to talk about what digital transformation can provide them. Mm-hmm. If you're talking to someone from HR about, you know, and trying to sell them on user experience design, you need to show how user experience design can affect and benefit them in their role. And so it goes on. You know, I don't think there's a lot of point. And that again, Jared was getting at that in his article that we mentioned, which is about how you can't convince executives to care about user experience. You need to identify what it is that they already care about, and then explain how user experience design can deliver that. Mm-hmm. So, which I totally agree with. Mm-hmm. Rachel, from your point of view, sorry, go ahead. Oh, what were you going to say?
Please.
I was just going to ask from your point of view, you know, a big part of what you do is actually requiring people to change their existing behaviors, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, and whether it be digital transformation, user experience design, project management, or whatever else, people don't like change. Mm-hmm. So what do you find works in order to encourage people to change their ways, so to speak?
Yeah, so there's this entire change management process, you know, in play here. And I think one of the biggest things that we need to start with is an awareness of where people are at, not just, you know, physically, but mentally as well. Kind of like what you guys talked about, right? You sort of do an assessment. But again, for the buy-in part, I mean, you're going to have people who are going to be more open to change. They're going to be champions. They're going to support you. And they're going to have people who are more resistant to change. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, what kind of mindset do they have? How open to, you know, transition are they in their own lives and their roles? Do they feel threatened? How will this impact them on a personal level? Like all of the things you just talked about. And really, I think we have to set the stage by having clarity around, okay, if we are going to be implementing change, how many people are feeling change fatigue? You know, because sometimes when people try to implement change, they've already tried a few things. It's not like we're just going to do this one thing, you guys, and then we promise we're never going to change anything again. It's like, oh, first they changed this, now they're changing, you know, now we have to do this thing. And it's like people start to, their resistance goes up because they feel threatened. And I actually, as part of the Digital PM Summit talk last year, I did some research on change management and sort of like the theories around that. And what I could not believe was that they said that there's this entire sort of scale of sort of grief. It's the same scale as the change resistance scale. So it's the Kubler-Ross model. And right? And then you react in the same way as you would when you are going through the grieving process with the whole denial, anger, sadness, you know, like all of those stages are the same. And so I was thinking, you know, like this is why it's so important for us to meet people where they are, because you don't know what they've been through as an individual, but even as an organization, I just read that people can actually carry like these memories stress memories that kind of like are shared throughout the organization, you can actually even take those and you can actually carry them through genetics. There's like this strange thing. Wow. I know, I blew my mind. There's memories of things that never happened to you can be carried through your DNA. I just read about this. And so imagine too, if you're living in a more stressful environment in a country that's maybe a little bit been through like some tragedy or wars, or there's just political instability, like all of those things kind of become elements when you're having these conversations, and you have to have a lot of sensitivity and really focusing on, sometimes they say like, if you are going to make habits change, like Charles Duhigg sort of talked about all these patterns of habit changing. And he said like, sometimes it's best to rupture a whole bunch of habits and restart something brand new, but you have to do that while asking people like, what do you need? Because if you try to come in and just sweep everything over, I mean, really, that's a lot of stress to have to deal with.
And I think there's a lot of collective habits as well, the unwritten rules of an organization that define its culture and its identity. And even though individuals within an organization can be entirely up for change, if the culture of the organization itself is resistant to change, it can be quite hard to shift the needle. So for example, I worked with one organization where, you know, senior management has said that we need to change, or everybody was up for it, everybody was enthusiastic, yet it wasn't happening. And as I dug, it was because everybody was afraid. They were afraid of what other people might think, or what reaction they would get if they did things differently. And there was this kind of unwritten thing that, well, I'm up for change, but everyone else isn't. And it wasn't true.
Wow.
And it was just kind of embedded in the culture somewhere. And so deconstructing that is challenging. You have to kind of drag the problem into the light, really, and say, look, this is a big issue. Everyone's saying the same thing, and identify the problem before you can begin to change it. So it's an interesting area. Anyway, we ought to get on to our last question before we run out of time, which is from Neil. He says, it strikes me that a lot of the things that we do as digital professionals could be automated, right? From things from like client communication to reporting. Now, he's saying, are we missing an opportunity here, or is the personal touch better? So I struggled with this question a little bit. So let me just kind of clarify an example that I have, where every month I have to send out a time bank report to the people that have bought mentorship hours with me to say how many they've got so far, you know, how many they've got left, etc. Now, I could write a bit of code that would churn that out and send it to them. And effectively automate it. But I choose not to, because I want to, say a little bit and say, yeah, it's been a while since I've spoken. How did that last meeting we had went, etc., etc. Now, this is quite an interesting project management issue here, or a people management issue. Of, on one hand, you know, as organizations were pushing all the time to be more and more efficient, no, I probably waste a good hour sending all of those emails out. But on the other hand, it is about relationships and people. So is that time well spent? Rachel, what do you feel about that?
Yeah, I have very, very strong and very mixed feelings about that, because I get that. You, first and foremost, I mean, we have to be humans, right? This is about people. There are no projects without people. And when there are, I don't know if I want to be a part of that world. At the same time, we know that, I mean, there is literally a wall of technology that is headed straight for us. And I mean, you know, my partner and I, part of our whole joke at Louder Than 10 is that like, we want to kind of automate our company enough to make it a machine so that we can be the humans that look after the humans that run the work, make everything else simple so that we're not bogged down in that. Like, our job as project managers is not to just manage schedules and manage timelines and manage, you know, capacity. It's to solve problems that people have, to have conversations and make them feel safe and make them feel like we're looking after them. So if I can do that job better, or if I can help my clients do that job better, I'm okay with using technology that allows me to automate it. So it's a really big controversial topic for sure.
Because that's nice. I like that way of thinking about it, mine, of seeing technology as an enabler to free up your own time to focus on people and relationships. Mm-hmm. That's quite a nice way of thinking of it.
Yeah, I mean,
Marcus, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, when I first read it, I nearly did a Jeremy Keith and rejected the premise of the question.
Why is that?
Because I just thought it didn't make sense. It was kind of, why would you want to kind of automate communication? And then I thought, well, yeah, okay, in some respects you might want to. Reporting is one thing. However, with the example you've given, we do the same thing every month with the various maintenance and support contracts we've got. And I don't think it's wasted time at all to communicate with people about sort of like, you know, we've used 3 or 4 hours of your time this month, blah, blah, blah. You know, you're making contact, even if it's just making contact or reminding them you exist, I think it gives it value. But it's also an opportunity to talk about what the next piece of work might be. So, all right. I was overdoing it with the rejecting the premise of the question, but I think that personal touch is really, really important. And I think if you just, if you gave somebody a login and said, right, this is where you can go and check out the numbers, I think you could end up losing a relationship if you did that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a tricky one. It's an interesting question because, you know, I'm a huge fan of automation and I'm a huge fan of getting work off my plate if I possibly can. But, you know, the more you automate something, the less communication there potentially is. And therefore, the more, going back to what we were talking right at the beginning, the more chance there is of misunderstanding, which ultimately costs your business, doesn't it?
Misinterpretation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, if there's a way to sort of automate the processes that support the communication so that the communication is still done by human beings to other human beings. But for example, like, do you guys use Slack at all or some kind of like, so do you have the daily stand-ups or like, I mean, we use, I think it's called Howdy or something. It's an integration, right? It allows you to say, what are you working on? Who do you need to talk to? Is there anything that's holding you up today? It's kind of like a stand-up, but it makes it so that everybody in the company knows what we're working on and we don't have to necessarily have a meeting to do it. It takes 2 minutes and it's done, and I don't feel like it has a negative impact on the type of work that we do. But I'm curious to hear, like, if you guys have any other examples or ideas around that.
But I don't think that example is automated. You still have to; it still has to be a human being entering, you know, words into something to explain whatever it is that they're working on. What the issues they are having. It's still human communication, even if it's just through a different kind of medium.
Mm-hmm.
My problem with this is the automation bit.
Yeah, it's that. But you've got to say, a tool like has just been described there, you know, you can do a daily stand-up in a fraction of the time you would do if you were speaking to one another. You know how daily stand-ups become. You just talked about it a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
You know, so in that regard, no, it's not automating it, but it is using technology to streamline it and make it more efficient.
Yes. And
that's a good thing, in my opinion.
I don't have a problem with that at all.
Okay, we'll leave that one there because I don't think there is a definitive answer to Neil's question, but it's a good conversation starter, if nothing else. I just want to quickly talk about our other sponsor, which is Shopify. Shopify is a leading multi-channel commerce software. It's got over 275 merchants, 275, that's not very good, is it? 275,000 merchants around the world using it. One of the reasons Shopify has grown to see such success is because they've worked on building a platform that can be easily used and built by designers and developers and people like that. It's very, very straightforward if you're a web designer and developer to use, and that's why it's become so popular. And they've actually gone one step further than just kind of building this very streamlined system for you to use. They've also shown a real commitment to the web community by creating what they call a Shopify Partner Program. And this program offers designers and developers new ways to earn passive income from building sites for their clients through a revenue sharing model that they do. So the more installations of Shopify that you sell to your clients, the more revenue you make off of that, as well as obviously the design and development work you do. Shopify partners also offers a variety of kind of free content with the purpose of helping freelancers, agencies, etc., grow and succeed. So last week I mentioned that Shopify has this amazing blog dedicated entirely to freelancers and agencies where you can get advice and support, not just on using Shopify, but on general design and development stuff. But that's not the only resource that they provide. They also do regular webinar series called a Shopify Partner Sessions that you can check out. So these are like hour-long webinars covering topics ranging from business strategy for agencies to advice on working with clients and tips about using the Shopify platform as well. So they regularly bring in special guests to run these webinars, including myself. I've done one or two of them, and I've written for their blog as well. You can find out more about the upcoming Shopify Partner Session webinars by going to the Shopify Design and Development blog at shopify.com/partners/blog. Okay, Marcus, do you have a joke to wrap us up?
I have a joke that you sent to me in the Biog World Slack channel that I missed. So
yeah, see? My own wonderful joke.
Yeah, here we go. I entered 10 puns into a pun contest to see which one would win. Unfortunately, no pun in 10 did.
That's brilliant.
That's good.
That was somebody on Twitter that shared that, and I can't remember who, so I apologise to whoever it was. It was almost certainly Bruce Lawson,
yeah,
because he does share a lot of jokes. So yes, that was a good one. So Rachel, thank you so much for coming on the show. Where can people find out more about you?
Definitely. Thanks so much, you guys. I really appreciate it. Come and find us at louderthan10.com. We are on Twitter and Facebook, and we're actually going to be speaking at the Design and Content Conference in Vancouver this year on July 22nd. And we're really excited to talk about design and content systems.
Oh, interesting stuff. It's been a long time since I've been to Vancouver. I feel a need for another trip before too long.
I'd love to see you. And Marcus, you guys should both come, and we will make our own worldwide country.
The last time I was in Vancouver, I think, was 1989.
Oh, my word, that was a long time ago. How old would you have been, Rachel, in 1989? I have to ask, just to embarrass Marcus.
I was 6.
Yes. Oh, I know.
I was 22.
So, just a reminder that we are always open to people's questions. We love getting your questions. You can send us questions at boag.world/questions and just post them as a comment, or email them to me at paul@boagworld.com. Joining us next week is Abby Covert, so you can be sure it's going to be a good show. Thank you, Rachel, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.